I'm going to read you a whole chapter of Scripture this morning. Is that okay? Yeah. Psalm 119. Just kidding. Actually, it won't be too hard to listen to because it's Luke 15, and it's a very awesome chapter that you're probably familiar with. But go ahead and listen to these three parables again that Jesus tells. It says, Luke 15, starting right in verse 1, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to hear him," that is Jesus. "And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, 'This man receives sinners and eats with them.' So he told them this parable. 'What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the one that is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying to them, "Rejoice with me, I found my sheep that was lost." Just so, I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, 'Rejoice with me, for I found the coin that I had lost.' Just so, I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents." And then he said, "There was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants." And he arose, and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. And bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and so he came and drew near to the house, and he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound." But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I've never disobeyed your command. Yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him." And he said to him, "Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found." Jesus strings together three parables here that have really the exact same meaning. So whatever he's trying to get across is probably pretty important, right? We are going to be spending most of our time over the next 2 weeks, can't do this in one, no way, looking at the third of these parables, the one about the lost son, which makes sense because you can make the case that Jesus uses the first two stories really to kind of set up the third one. The parable of the prodigal son, as we call it, is so rich in meaning and so detailed in the way that Jesus tells it. It's possible to look at this story from different angles. In fact, there's at least three different angles that you can legitimately look at this story from. You'll notice from the way that Luke sets it up that we have tax collectors and sinners, which probably means prostitutes, it often does, flocking to Jesus to hear him speak and to teach. And these people are obviously represented by this younger son in the parable, so it's only natural sometimes to see that son as the main character. That's why we usually name the parable after him, right? It's the parable of the prodigal or lost son. On the other hand, Luke also mentions that there are other people there. The scribes and the Pharisees are there, and they're getting all huffy about how Jesus is welcoming these sinners, and since they are obviously represented by the older son in the parable, it's certainly valid to see him, the older son, as the main character instead. And if you look at the way the story ends, that view might be the most accurate, technically speaking, that it's about him. But then there's another character in the story who needs our attention, perhaps more than the other two. And I would argue that of all the tension in the story, it's all due to the fact that this one character is so badly misunderstood by the other two characters. And of course, that character is the father. And the father represents God the Father. What I want to do today is spend next week, not today, but I want to spend next week looking at the two sons in this parable. And this week, probing into the character of the other character, the father. Because quite honestly, all of us, even as Christians, have the same tendency to mischaracterize and misunderstand our Heavenly Father as those two boys or sons both misunderstood and mischaracterized their earthly father. So we have to ask ourselves, what is God like? What is God like? What is God really like? Okay, well, let's go to the Bible and think about that. We know that he's holy, which means that he's perfect, which means he has no flaws at all in his character. Beyond that, we know that God is both all-knowing and all-powerful. And so by definition, since he's all-knowing and all-powerful, he is in control of all of creation, since he has both the knowledge and the power he needs to change anything in it if he wants to. We also know that God is absolutely unchanging. Immutable is what the theologians use. That's the word they use to describe that characteristic of God. He doesn't change. We sang this morning, there is no shadow of turning with God. He is faithful. What he is today, he always will be. But it's very easy to take all that knowledge of God and to put it together and to conclude that God is not just unchanging in his character, but to conclude also that he is static in his emotions, which is not the same thing. Think about this. If someone asks you, does God feel? Does God have emotions? What would you say? Yes. You'd probably say yes, right? Because, first of all, because we know that he gets angry sometimes, right? That's all over the Old Testament, right? He's an angry God. And he probably gets happy too. I guess he gets happy in there somewhere. But if God does have emotions, he probably exercises them in a very sedate and tame and kind of in control sort of way, right? Because he's God. God would never get carried away with emotion. That's what we impulsive, immature humans do. But God is above all that, right? After all, he's God. Right? He's God. There was a song that came out a couple years ago. I'm going to wade into it now, folks. The song used the word reckless to describe God's love. And a lot of people have objected to that song for many different reasons, and we haven't sung it here at First Alliance just because some of the objections to that song I think are reasonable, and because I don't want to sing a song that leads to division in our worship service because it's not worth inviting that into our body. But let me say this. If the idea of describing God's love is as reckless presents a problem for you because you associate the word reckless with reckless driving or reckless talk or being thoughtless and destructive and not caring who gets hurt by your actions, then I understand why you would have a problem with that song. I get it, okay? I can go there. On the other hand, please listen, because if you have issues using the word reckless to describe God's love because you are uncomfortable with or even threatened by the idea that God is somehow passionate and deeply emotional, maybe even to the point of being overcome with emotion at times, then let me invite you to reconsider some things as we look at this chapter, because God may not be exactly who you think he is. The people that are listening to Jesus in this chapter were, you know, Jews. They had the Old Testament. And if they had ever read the book of Hosea, they would have known that their God was full of emotion. In that book, in the book of Isaiah, God is very upset with his people, okay? He's angry. He's ticked off. And he's particularly mad at the northern kingdom of Israel. That's where Hosea was sent. And they have been consistently worshiping other gods. They've basically been committing spiritual adultery. They've been betraying God. And God is angry, but that's not the only emotion he has. And God reaches a kind of crisis point in chapter 11 of Hosea, verses 8 to 9. I'm going to read them to you. He says this. God says, "How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? how can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboim? Those were two cities that were destroyed along with Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, how can I do that? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. Here we see a God who is not just feeling emotions, but he's actually feeling conflicting emotions, right? And he's wrestling with them. Not only is he wrestling with them, but he's letting his people know that he's wrestling with them. He's communicating that to them through the prophet. God, yes, even the God of the Old Testament, is a God of deep emotion, deep feeling. And it's way more than just anger, of course. He's full of compassion for his people. So as we come back to Luke 15 and we look at these two warm-up parables, if you will, that Jesus tells before he gets to the prodigal son one, we see him appealing to the emotions of the people that are listening to him. He starts out by talking about this sheep that gets lost and how the shepherd is so concerned that he actually leaves 99 other sheep in the open field to go find the lost sheep. And if we're not careful, the way we respond to that is by saying, wow, isn't God's love amazing that he would do something as radical and bizarre as that, leaving 99 sheep to go off and find the lost one? But if we said that, we would miss the point. Because if you look at how Jesus starts the parable, look at the first words. He says, which of you? Which of you, Pharisees and scribes, would not do the same thing? Which of you would not do this if all of a sudden your sheep came up missing? Admit it, Jesus says. Even though it might seem illogical or even dangerous to have 99 sheep out in the open field and leave them there, go looking for the one that got lost, you'll still do it. And why will you do it? Well, because if you don't, all you'll be thinking about is what? That sheep. Where is that sheep? Where is that poor sheep? What is happening to him? Is he somehow trapped? Is he injured? Is there a wolf tracking him down at this very moment and he's going to attack him and rip him apart and that sheep is just standing there helpless and wondering where I am? You wouldn't be able to sleep thinking about that poor animal, even though it's only an animal. And so you'd walk away from the 99 because you're so concerned about the one. Now, is that unreasonable? Maybe. But sometimes emotion is so powerful that it trumps reason, right? Jesus says the joy you feel when you find that lost sheep and you put them on your shoulders and return home is the joy that happens in heaven when a lost person, human being, comes back to God. That's a powerful story. But Jesus is just getting started. He goes and tells another parable here. See, it's easy sometimes to have sympathy for animals, isn't it? We love animals. Because we tend to think of them as helpless and innocent and they don't know what's going on. So we feel for them. They arouse our compassion. But you know what? We can get just as worked up about our money. And this is not a condemnation. It's understandable. It's natural. And Jesus, again, appeals to people to identify with the person who's the main character of the next parable. Let's bring this one, this second parable, into the 21st century, okay? Let's say you're in your 60s, mid-60s. A bunch of people just looked up. Woo, okay, that's me. And you're finally ready to retire. Just a few more months, and then you can hang it up, and you're good to go. And you've got a little nest egg set up. And you won't live like a king. It's not that huge. You can't travel the world for your whole retirement and all that. But there's enough for you to get by on if you're reasonably careful about how you spend it. You should be okay in retirement. It might be close, but you think you'll make it. And then one day you'll get a notice from the company that administers your retirement account confirming the withdrawal of about 35% of your balance. And you didn't do that. Uh-oh. Suddenly it occurs to you, somebody stole my identity. What do you do in this situation? Do you say, oh, well, maybe that money will come back? No. First of all, you pray, if you remember to do that in your panic, and then you get on the phone, and you get on the internet, you talk to whoever you have to talk to, you bring whatever resources and connections you have to bear upon this problem before it's too late, and that money is gone forever, right? That's what I would do. That's probably the closest thing we could experience today that would approximate the plight of the woman in this parable. And imagine how happy you would be if you managed to retrieve that retirement money. You probably would throw a party, right? Take your friends out to dinner. Say, you guys have no idea what just happened to me, and I'm so relieved. Let me tell you about it. and tell them all to get LifeLock or whatever, right? Now, Jesus' hearers, they're starting to get it, but they don't know exactly where he's headed, because although he's talked about the angels in heaven, he doesn't bring out the big guns until this third parable. And so they won't know for sure that Jesus is talking specifically about the love of God the Father until the moment that that father of the prodigal son runs down the street to embrace his son. But if you read back into these first two stories, we have to ask the question, do you think that God is capable of the same emotions felt by the people in these stories? Does God, the great shepherd, feel the kind of compassion for lost people that makes a human being obsess over a lost animal or a lost sheep? And that sometimes leads us to even act irrationally? Does God have that emotion? Does God feel something like that woman's panic at the loss of a person that he lovingly created, such that he goes all out and he conducts a feverish search to bring that person home to himself? Does God really feel that way? Does God really throw big parties in heaven when people get saved? How does God think? How does God feel? How did God feel when Adam and Eve sinned in the garden? You ever thought about his side of the story? After Adam and Eve sinned, the first words that God speaks to them, if you go back and look at Genesis 3, it's just a question. And the question is, hey, where are you? Where are you guys? Of course, did he know where they were? He's God. He knew where they were. So why ask the question? What does this convey? A few of you will remember this. One of the earliest contemporary Christian music artists, even before my time, so this is old, but it's a guy named Don Francisco. Anyone remember him? One of his songs was just called Adam. And in that song, he repeats these words of the chorus over and over again in a frantic voice. Adam, Adam, where are you? Adam, Adam, where are you? And the first time I heard that, I was just shocked. How could God talk like that? It just didn't seem normal, but boy, it was. That's what it was like. Did God know when he created Adam and Eve they were going to fall into sin? He did. He knew it was coming. Probably wanted to look away. Do you think it made it any easier to watch what took place just because he knew? Did it make it any easier that these two people into whom he had placed his own image and invested so much in the relationship and made them co-partners in ruling the earth, how did he feel as he watched Eve kind of turn things over in her mind as the serpent was talking to her and trying to get her to doubt God's goodness and God's character and God's truthfulness and God's love? As he sees her reasoning her way through it, and then as she actually agrees with the serpent and bites into the fruit. What was it like to see Adam so thoughtlessly and blindly follow along? God may have known this was coming, but do you really think that took the sting out of it? Now I want you to think about how the father in this parable feels when his own son, into whom he has poured his own love and effort for many years, comes up and says, Dad, can I have my inheritance now? Which is basically the same as saying this. Hey, Dad, it's taking too long for you to die. So can I just sort of take my money and get on with my life already? That's what he's saying. But here is where the love of the father for his messed up son leads him to do the first of two crazy sounding things. The first thing he does is this: he lets him go. He actually relinquishes the financial control he has held over his son, and he grants the request. Okay, here's the money. Here's the property. You see, the man realizes that by keeping his son at home, where he'll be safe, where he won't be able to actually destroy his life, is actually not the best thing for his son. So even though it breaks his heart and leads to so much pain, he allows his son the freedom to discover the things out in the harsh world that he would never have learned hanging around the house. This is so incredible a thought for today's parents, right? Like us, right? Our generation, most of us will do anything to keep our kids from pain, right? We will do anything to keep our kids safe and sheltered in the short term, even if it might stunt their growth in the long term. What is amazing here is that God the Father, even though he is literally omnipresent, right? He still refuses the temptation to be a helicopter parent. But he does it out of love, knowing that, yeah, it's going to cause pain, but knowing this is the only path that will lead to salvation. It's tough. The Father lets his Son go. But then again, he kind of doesn't, right? The Son is out of sight, but definitely not out of mind. And we see when the Son finally shows up, when he comes back, comes to his senses, we'll look at his story next week, but when the Son finally shows up on the horizon, Dad is right there, and his eyes are peeled. I picture him kind of sitting on the porch, ready to receive the Son back. Where is he? Is he coming today? Is he coming today? He probably got up every morning. And there he was. He sees the Son coming a long way off. He runs to him. He runs to him. He embraces him, and he kisses him. This crazy welcome home is the second really unexpected thing the Father's love leads him to do. Definitely unexpected from the Son's point of view. It's kind of crazy, especially the running part. Because in that culture, a man in that father's position would never run in that situation. It's demeaning. Where Dawn and I went to school, we had East and West campuses at our university. And they were about 2-3 miles apart. And so sometimes you had classes on both campuses. And so there were times, especially when you were a lowly freshman and you couldn't really control your schedule, where you had to take a bus from one campus to the other campus in time for your next class. And if your first class got out late, or if you got delayed, or for some other reason, you would find yourself running at top speed to catch the bus. And it was kind of a tradition for the upperclassmen, especially the ones in the fraternities, to sit on their benches in front of their dorms. And if any like freshman would break into a run trying to catch the bus, he would just yell, "Don't run for the bus." I don't know how many times I heard that. "Don't run for the bus." Now, obviously, it was not against the rules to run for the bus. What the guy was invariably communicating was this: that when you tear off after the bus with your big old backpack on, or everything's kind of flying around like that, you look like a total geek. And you're making Duke look uncool. So don't do it, dude. There is absolutely no dignity in running for a bus. But you know what? I'm thinking, listen, psych major on your bench over there, you haven't gone to class in 3 weeks. I have a test on East Campus, and I'm running for the bus because it's important to me. I don't care if I look like a geek. I'm an engineer. I'm already a geek. But at the same time, I'll kind of make it look like I'm walking so I can be kind of a little bit cool. You know. You see, in our story, it's the Son who should be running to the Father, not the other way around. The more dignified, more important party does not exert himself in this way. But here comes the Son, back from his time eating pig slop, or actually wishing he could eat pig slop, apparently, probably looking like something the cat dragged in, getting close to his old house, and he's rehearsing the speech he's going to give to his dad. So he's kind of probably fumbling his way down the road, not going too fast. He's getting close to his old house. He's going through the speech one more time, when all of a sudden, he sees something. It's an old man coming up over the hill, and he's grabbing his robe with both hands, which you would have had to do if you were running, and holding it up awkwardly, trying to preserve something of his decency, if not his dignity, running over the hill. Apparently, whoever this is so excited about something that he doesn't care that he's looking like a total geek. And the young man's eyes grow increasingly wide with shock as he realizes just who it is that's running toward him. Who is it? It's our God. It's the Holy One of Israel. It's the most dignified and exalted being in all of existence. He shouldn't have to run for anything. But he's so happy that a sinner has come home that he can't help himself. He can't keep from running for us. What if one night you were asleep in your bed at 4 o'clock in the morning and the phone rang? Who is it? It's the police. you and your spouse get up. Ma'am, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but your son was just killed in an automobile accident. Every parent's nightmare. We're going to need you to come down to the station first thing in the morning, if you don't mind. For the next half hour, you're totally paralyzed. You don't think, you just feel, and you don't know what's going on. You kind of absentmindedly get your clothes on and prepare to leave the house. Half an hour later, the phone rings again. It's the police again. Ma'am, your son just showed up at the station reporting that his car was stolen along with his ID and his wallet. We're sorry to have troubled you. Okay. Now, is that manipulating your emotions? Probably. But did you notice what the father said twice in this parable? My son was dead, and now he's alive. Does God really feel that? Does God really feel that deeply? Is God really subject to those emotions? It's hard for us to think about God in those terms, honestly, because when we think about it, it's true that a lot of our emotions, like worry and anxiety and panic and frustration and fear, and even things like joy and relief, those emotions are tied to the fact that we human beings are weak and helpless and we're not in control of everything, right? And we don't know what's going to happen next. And we think, well, God is different because God is in control and God does know what's going to happen next. Think of it like this. The way that we experience, as human beings, the way that we experience life, feelings are not really things that we initiate, right? I mean, you can't just make yourself have a feeling. You try sometimes, but you really can't. Feelings are things that happen to us, right? We're passive in them. They happen to us. But God is sovereign. God is the Lord of all creation. God is in control. God is he's the initiator. God is the one who makes things happen, by definition, right? So things don't just happen to God, do they? Or do they? This morning we're going to end our service by taking communion together, and this always reminds us of how God came after us. The suffering of Jesus. Those things he went through leading up to the cross and then finally being crucified and dying in our place. And one of the ways that Christians have traditionally referred to this experience of Jesus is by calling it his passion. Right? The passion of our Lord. Sometimes we call it Passion Week. Mel Gibson made a movie 15 years ago about the suffering of Jesus. Remember what it was called? The Passion of the Christ. And the word passion is a very interesting one. Today we usually use it to describe very intense feelings, right? Things that we're passionate about. We also use it in relation to romantic love or sexual desire. Sometimes we talk about doing things in the heat of passion. Why? Because our emotions and our desires just were so strong that we got carried away with them, so we did it in the heat of passion. But the traditional meaning of this word, a more basic meaning, has to do with suffering. The Greek word from which we get our word passion is typically translated to suffer. And we know that during that week leading up to Calvary, Jesus suffered greatly, which is why this is often referred to as his Passion Week. And yet, if you dig a little bit deeper into the root meaning of that word, you find out that at its most basic level, that word means to be acted upon. To be acted upon. We get our English word passive from this word, the opposite of active. We're active when we're doing things, right? We are passive when things are happening to us. And sure enough, we find out that not only was the last week of Jesus' life a time of great emotion, starting from when he came in on the donkey and saw Jerusalem and was weeping outwardly over the fate of the city that he loved. Not only was it a week of intense suffering, but at some point in that week, right around Thursday night, actually, Jesus, as we look at his experience, he went from doing things to having things done to him, didn't he? He was betrayed, passive voice. He was overcome with sorrow. He was arrested. He was disowned. He was deserted. He was tried. He was lied about. He was convicted. He was beaten. He was stripped of his clothing and all of his dignity. He was insulted. He was ridiculed. He was spit upon. He was taunted. He was rejected. He was flogged. He was forced to carry his cross. And finally, he was forsaken. He was executed. He was killed. And all this time, he never lifted a finger or spoke a word to stop these things from happening. Although Jesus never stopped being the Lord of all creation, he never acted. He never acted. He never did anything. That's right. Remember who Jesus was. He was God. That was God. Yes, he was human. We talked about that a lot last week. Jesus was 100% human, but he was also every bit as much God as God the Father was. He was all-powerful and all-knowing, and yet somehow he became helpless. Our God became helpless because it was the only way that he could save us. A shepherd worried about his sheep, running off and leaving his post because he can't stand to let the animal go and he can't stop thinking about him. A poor woman turning her house upside down, frantically searching for a lost coin that is worth so much to her. A heartbroken father making a fool of himself, running down the street to embrace the son who had so coldly rejected him. These are all just pictures that Jesus painted of the love of God and what Jesus himself was about to suffer for you and me. I don't know if God's love is reckless or not. It probably depends on your definition of that word. But there is no question that his love is passionate in every sense of the word. So as we come to the Lord's table today, let's remember what he did and what he had done to him, because he couldn't let us go and because he loved us that deeply, that strongly, that desperately, and still does. Will you come to him this morning? He's reaching out to you. Whether you don't know him yet and you're surprised that God the Father would go to these lengths to love you that much and would feel that way about you, or whether you're already a believer but God has become this kind of impassive deity that just stands up there and grades you for things. It's not who he is. He loves you. He's passionate about you. Let's pray.